The following podcast is not relating to my teachings and work at Del Cid Medical Center and is for entertainment purposes only.
Welcome, everybody. Another exciting Life of a Flow episode today, brought to you by Lucas and Miguel. And today we're going to be having a conversation with a good friend, Sean Morris. Sean's a medical device executive, entrepreneur, investor, strategist, consultant, so on and so forth. Has a trajectory of a very successful business acumen, and currently is leading a company called Amplify Vascular. You'll get to learn much more about it. You'll learn a little bit about Sean, about what makes him tick, and then we'll gravitate a little bit towards what the company is, where it's at, what its reach can be, and you'll see we are very excited. We feel very positively about where this company is going, and I would keep an eye on it because I think there are pretty good things yet to come.
Yeah, this is super interesting.
So anyway, stay tuned and let's talk to Sean Morris.
Vamos.
Vámonos.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the Life of Flow podcast.
All right, Sean. Well, buddy, thank you for coming, man. It just means a lot. I know Izama always ping you down when you're vacationing, which means two things. Either my timing is always perfect of knowing when you're off, or which is exactly, or my actual hypothesis, which is Sean's always on vacation. So what is it, Sean? Are you always on vacation, or am I just always pinning you down when you are on the 1 or 2 days of vacation a year?
I'll tell you what, when you love what you do, it's always a vacation.
Boom. Well, good answer. That's what I'm talking about. That's how you make the big bucks right there, brother.
Yeah. You know, it's, you could catch me as a stress ball, or you can catch me on a Saturday, which is what we're doing. Indulge everybody. I have,
Where are you at? Yeah. Tell us where you're at.
To show the audience, you know, the beauty, a beautiful part of Missouri in the middle, south of Jefferson City at a beautiful lake called Lake of the Ozarks, made famous by the Netflix series that people might have seen.
I've heard the drugs out there are amazing, man.
They are. Yeah. I'm on some right now. talking to you.
Oh, man. In all seriousness, you know, Sean and I go a few years back, initially as a, you know, business and transactional, and evolving into a friendship of respect, of mentorship, of mutual intellectual enticement, I would say. He's the guy, you know, that I like calling when I have a question about, you know, a relationship with industry, or, hey, you know, here's a safe note, or, you know, what do you think about this thing? Or, hey, I have an idea I want to build. And I think we still have to be better, Sean, at going from talking to making, but I think it's just a matter of time. Not everything, Rome wasn't built over one day. So I think that a lot more still needs to be written in our stories, and I look forward to that. But at least today, I was really interested in having you over. I wanted you to, I think you had met Lucas. Had you met Lucas at some point, or is this a formal introduction to Lucas?
I think it's the first introduction.
Yes, that's correct. Okay. Well, this is my introduction to Lucas and to the about 1 million followers. we're like kicking doors and becoming the most nationally renowned podcast. So anyway, being that we only have high level guests, I thought you would fit that fantastically well. How about you summarize a little bit about your background in business and how you got into med tech, and tell me a little bit about, you know, I know you've had some pretty good projects turn. Maybe you want to tell us a little bit about how you've gotten where you are.
You bet. Appreciate the opportunity. You know, I'm in an area that I love because of just, you know, the bumping into various things that got me to where I'm at. How's that for word salad?
That's it.
That's okay.
I have a degree in biochemistry, so, you know, I've loved the sciences. had aspirations of being, you know, a doctor. For whatever reason, I was drawn to nephrology back in the day. In order to facilitate a curiosity there and understand it, I went to a dialysis center and saw a bunch of people sitting in chairs getting dialysis. And then I realized I didn't want to be a nephrologist. It seemed like a tough grind. But in any case, I leaped out of school into technology and sales. It wasn't where I wanted to be at the beginning. But I, by virtue of just being a good guy, I met a gal that worked for me. Her husband worked for a company called AngioDynamics, and he was getting promoted, and he had seen how I was managing sales teams and thought I would be a good person to come in and backfill his spot. And that's really the spark of the crazy life that I live in right now, because I got to see for the first time doctors doing procedures under x-ray. And back then it was cut. Most of it was cut film, believe it or not. And they didn't have the capabilities they have right now. So they were taking a picture and then looking at it and saying, okay, yeah, the wire is where it needs to be. And imagine how tough that would be today. It would drive you crazy, Miguel, because you want to keep moving and your energy level so high, it would drive you nuts.
That's one of those. Tell me your age without telling me your age, Sean.
Right.
Yeah. So I was. Here's one for me. Is I did trans lumbar aortograms.
Really?
Wow.
You didn't know that, did you?
No, I did not.
In Costa Rica, when we started, we didn't have injectors and sheets and all that.
Jesus Christ.
So we would put patients in decubitus, lateral decubitus, and you'd come from the back and you'd poke the bone of the back, and then start going through the lumbar processes in the body, and then boom, you would hit the pulse of the aorta, and you'd put this big needle, like a 20 centimeter needle, and then connect that to the injector, and then it would just create an aortogram, and then you would get a couple of shots, like Sean said, like bam bam bam, three x-rays. I lived that. So tell me your age without telling me your age. I did trans lumbar aortograms. All right, Sean. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, no, we've come so far, right? So at AngioDynamics, I think you guys are both familiar with that company. It's a company that I'll always love forever. I own stock in it, just because I'm constantly rooting for them to do good. And there's people there that I still know, but the one individual there to name drop was the founder of AngioDynamics. His name is Eamon Hobbs. Eamon's an engineer by education, and started the company based on wanting to facilitate CO2 angiography. And this is a great little nugget, little history lesson for anybody. The reason why we have radio pig tip catheters is because the catheters that were being used in CO2 angiography, we weren't radio pig, you couldn't see them. And so in order to help get CO2 angiography utilized more, and they had a CO2 injector and everything, they had to put radio pig tips on the catheter so the physician could see them in the blood vessel and know where they were prior to injecting CO2. Because as you all know, it's not the best imaging agent out there from a visualization standpoint. Now, imaging equipment's gotten better. Technology's gotten better. You can see it better. But, you know, imagine 20 years ago trying to see CO2 in a blood vessel. So he loved innovation. He loved, he's still alive. I mean, he's still running a company, but he loves innovation. He loves working with physicians, as did I. I found that pretty early when I was in there, just intellectually curious. Yes, I did good at sales. Yes, I made a lot of money at sales, but it wasn't stimulating enough. I wasn't getting enough out of it. I had to go deeper, and I didn't know this at the time, but I was on this journey to innovate and work with physicians. Didn't know what to do or how to do that. Eamon, I think, saw that in me and promoted me pretty aggressively through management, and really put me in a position to move to upstate New York, where the company was located at that time. Ripped my wife and two kids out of St. Louis, moved upstate New York. January 2nd, when it was 1 degree outside, she was totally pissed, but very supportive of her husband and his career goals. and it was cold as you know what. So we, you know, we went up there and I became the global vice president of marketing, and I was not qualified to do that. And you don't understand everything there is about marketing. And I was managing project managers that have been in, you know, these roles for a long time. And I probably came in like a bull in a china shop trying to, you know, superimpose whatever I knew, and, you know, be the man. But, you learn pretty quickly that there's a lot you don't know. And, you know, to this day, those people are still near and dear in my heart. But then Miguel, I got promoted again, you know, a year and change after that to running the peripheral vascular business, which ended up being about $150 million division. And when I started at Angio, we had about $20 million in total global revenues. So it was a huge, fast ramp. Again, always above my skis. And that run in New York at Angio D was a 3-year commitment my wife made to me before I, you know, had to jump into no man's land and get her back to her family and her support system in St. Louis. Truth is, we made a lot of great friends in New York to this day. We had our third daughter, Kate, who's our New York baby, born up there. She's got the attitude and everything along with it. And fighter. He has the 80s style feathered hair. She's now a freshman in high school, or going to be a sophomore in high school. Time flies so fast. But I started Veniti, my venous stent company, because I'd really studied venous disease as an area that we could win at AngioDynamics. And it was either that or kidney. And we sort of did some acquisitions and some development in both. But I took the venous learnings and concepts into starting Veniti, which originally was a venous roll-up of three different technologies and a superficial venous ablation technology that used steam, which is really cool. It's like saran wrap on blood vessels or shrink wrap on blood vessels. A really interesting removable asterisk vena cava filter. At the time, litigation became, you know, normalized with a migration of IBC filters. So bad timing for that. And then the venous stent. So the venous stent was the technology that we ultimately focused on. We put the other two to the side. Takes a village to raise a child, but we developed something, you know, raised venture capital dollars, ended up selling that technology to Boston Scientific. And I wish they would have done more with it, frankly. Those things happen. From there, as you know, Miguel, that's when our journey together started after that, when I started to run this really unique, mind-boggling iron nanoparticle injected technology that uses a rotating magnetic field to augment the delivery of fluids downstream. So using a physics-based approach at a nanoscale to deliver blood flow into, you know, small targets that wires and catheters can't penetrate, increasing perfusion from head to toe. That company is still out there in a stroke trial. It's called Euphrates Vascular. And that brings me to today, and then I'll shut up for a second because I'm being very loquacious, but then I jump to something else that is bringing us back together again in a very vascular surgery centric area where we're trying to, turn vascular access upside down by using a centrifugal pump, non-pulsatile, that is a venous to venous connection, whereby we take blood flow out of the SVC right atrium, like a dialysis catheter, pull it into a wearable pump, and that forcibly pushes blood down into a forearm vein, rapidly enlarging that, making that more amenable, higher flow, higher value for you to take, you know, the artery connected to the vein and make that conduit, but do so very, very quickly, reliably, again, surpassing the KDOQI guidelines for AV fistula in terms of diameter and flow. So 10 patients conducted so far, where we've taken this pump system and we've taken on average 1.7 millimeter blood vessels, and in a couple of days got them to over 5 millimeters in diameter and flowing at 600 or 700 milliliters or more.
Wow.
So really cool stuff, right in your wheelhouse.
That's awesome.
Sean,
as you have very well summarized an incredibly successful career, and knowing that half of our listeners are physicians, the other half are actually industry folks. Do you believe that for those out there that are interested in entrepreneurship, having those formative years in a structured company are a must, or kind of along the lines of, you know, Elon or other very successful people, there's really no schooling for entrepreneurship. And if you've got the bug, you just have to find the way to do it. I mean, you've been obviously through structured and unstructured startup, successful. Talk to me a little bit about what you would advise to some young bucks that are interested in entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I don't think it's a must. You know, certainly helpful. And I think good ideas and desire and stick-to-itiveness, there's so many things that have to be, you know, outside of that. I mean, your life gets in the way, right? So if somebody told me a while ago, which is very interesting, when you're younger, you have a lot of energy, but you don't know what the hell you're doing, to paraphrase. And then when you're older, you have a lot more resources and wisdom, but you have less energy. So the idea is to find where the lines cross. And then you throw in, hey, do I have children? Did I get married and have children? And then you want to be, in my case, in our case, is a good dad, and you want to be there at front and center. You don't want to have to choose a career over being a dad or vice versa. You want to have both, and it's very difficult. So therefore, to answer your question, you can be in an environment where you can develop those skills, but you may miss the bus, the train stop, because, life might get in the way, or you might be on a particular trajectory, and it makes it more difficult to go back. And if you're a physician, what I found to be very interesting is a lot of these physicians are cutting their teeth as medical directors or chief medical officers for companies. And then they get the inside perspective of how difficult, if we're talking about device development, it is to get anything. And I say this with all due respect to the FDA, but it's very difficult to get technologies through the FDA and have the money and the patience to handle that. It's difficult. And then, the next, equally difficult part is getting it into the market. I like to work on technologies that don't need to prove the dog is going to eat the dog food, right? The clinical data is so compelling and so good, and the unmet need has been met with clinical data, that I would be able to sell this idea and concept with a lot of hard work and effort to an acquiring company, and they have existing sales or marketing organizations that are amazing. They can take it and they can do it better than anything we could do to start up. So the next challenge is getting it into the market. If you have to bootstrap that and raise money to do it, you're basically diluting all the people that did all the work by having to hire, a sales organization to go out and show commercial traction, wait 6 months for value analysis to get into a Baylor or Methodist or larger hospital systems. And you're just burning a lot of cash. So it's difficult, but to the core of your question, yes, you can be helped by doing that. You could also be an Elon Musk, as you referenced, and just be, a totally different type of a person and get it done. It's never too late. It's never too early. So I don't want to, talk in really broad strokes, but there are things that can certainly limit you. At the same time, there's lots of opportunities if you want to do it.
How do you, because obviously this is a big, I imagine that when you decide to go into one of these companies, like the nanoparticle company, the facial the vein maturation company, these are novel technologies. It's kind of like you're the one. And I imagine it's a big gamble, because you decide to put all this time and all this energy into a project that you're the first one. So,
Yeah, it's not a 510K approval for a DCB.
Exactly.
It's like a totally novel disruptive technology.
Can you walk us through the process of how you make that decision? Okay, I'm going to dedicate the energy and my time for all these years that's not insignificant into this technology because of A, B, C, and D that I see are like green lights.
You bet. Where I get a lot of, validation is from the doctors. And I'll tell a specific story about the nanoparticle technology, and Miguel, one of our mutual friends, Joel Crater, who's always been a great supporter of mine, and you know, just a good guy who knows everybody on the planet, basically. He said,
"Invite Joel here. We're waiting for him to accept."
Oh yeah, we'll have to get Joel on. If he could have came here with me, I'll pretend I got Joel next to me here. he said, "Hey, I want you to meet my friend Miguel Montero Baker," and I'm like, "Okay, give me the backstory. Who's Miguel?" He's like, "He's a vascular surgeon, and he's in Texas." And I'm like, "Okay, great." So we go up this elevator shaft, and I have five or six physicians, endovascular specialists of various specialties in the room. And I pull out some eye candy, the videos that I've created, these bench tests and moving fluids and how these little particles are rolling. And I don't know Miguel at all. I have no idea who he is, but he has his hands over his eyes like this, like he's hungover maybe or something. And he's just doesn't care at anything I'm talking about whatsoever. And I'm like, "Well, I'm really bombing this. And Joel, thanks for setting me up for failure." And what I didn't understand at the time is just the amount of thoughts and processing that was happening in his brain. As we all know, people that know Miguel know how curious he is and how energizing he is. And I didn't know that, because I just thought it was some guy who could give two, what's about what I was talking about. So afterwards he goes, "This is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen." I'm paraphrasing, but it was there that sparked that. Sean, what the hell are you doing? This is going to, this could change everything I'm doing. And there's so much opportunity here. That led to cadaver studies that we did together, which were huge for me. And having more validation with showing the technology beyond the bench, moving through tissues, albeit dead tissue, but still the vasculature is there. And I think that was really interesting for you too, Miguel, to see, how these particles were going from the injection site out to even to the wounds and perfusing all the way through these little bitty blood vessels. And then that also then led as a building block to our first in human studies we did together in critical limb-threatening ischemia, which, Miguel, you had a tremendous impact on that story and helping me validate the technology in some areas. But you're right, Lucas, it's, when I choose these innovative things, that is not something I would tell anybody to do as a first try, right? I'd mentioned on the front end that I'm drawn to things that aren't easy. They're novel, that therefore they're more difficult, but I can't do it without physicians.
Is there anything about the business team that drives, that gives you comfort as like a, particular, people that you're going to be involved from the business standpoint and what they bring to the table that you look for in these type of circumstances?
Absolutely. It takes a village to raise a company. So along the years, I've been blessed to work with some people that are really smart. So you talk about engineers that can reduce something down to, they have to, sometimes they have to develop the models that they're proving the technologies in, because those don't exist. So they have to use materials to bring tubing together and, what kind of surface and what kind of rig might it need to be on, trying to replicate, and prepare for animal studies or human studies and showing that proof of concept. And FDA requires it. I mean, there's that part of the engineering. They call it the benchtop testing stuff. So that requires engineers. Then you have to have somebody who's really on the front end from a regulatory perspective. What is the likely regulatory path for this technology? Is it a 510K? Is it a PMA? Those are different because they require different testing, documentation, and then the clinical study is more arduous. Some devices you can get in the market without doing a study down the 510K path, although I would still advocate to do that because you might have something that is interesting but relatively worthless. And if you have a randomized study to show comparatively how A versus B, looks in terms of superiority or something similar, at least that is really, really helpful. But understanding the regulatory path, and then you've got a clinical, folks, not only internally, but also working with your advisory board, your clinician friends, to make sure that you're not just building something in a vacuum and doing things wrong. And you have to hand it over to somebody at some point in time. So getting them in earlier is really, really helpful. And then there's quality folks, you know, that are just a rare breed of person that I have no idea why anybody wants to be a quality engineer, but God love them because they like the organization and they're that kind, you know, they're those types of people that chase signatures and get the documents together. And then on the business side, you know, it's money. You know, we have to have capital to make progress. And having a bolus of capital is great. It's dangerous for some because they start buying t-shirts and hats and marketing merch and stuff like that. Ideally, you want to spend every single dollar on clinical data that you can. That's where it should go. But you need somebody to help you manage that. And then legal would be the last one, you know, making sure you have your corporate documents in line. So it sounds very, very heavy, and it is. But those are the people that you rely upon, and they don't have to all be full-time employees.
Interesting.
One thing that I think it's almost like, like it takes a certain class of crazy person like yourself to exactly because the odds, I mean, Ryan was mentioning 1 out of 10, but I don't think that's right. I don't think do you know, are there any statistics? I know startups are like 1 out of like 1,000 make it, like when you take like everything, right? Like, but in med tech, what's the, I don't even know what the batting range is, the batting average for how many med tech companies actually make it. Do you know what the, is there any statistics on this?
Well, let's be a little friendlier than 1 out of 10, because you have to define success as something, right? If you're talking about like a crazy exit, less than 1 out of 10.
I would say, yeah. Talk
about listen. Any kind of like exit in terms of, even if you transfer the technology and there's some royalty or some upside, you know, as part of it, I would say it's maybe 2 or 3 out of 10. But if you're looking at through the lens of a venture capitalist, you know, they're making bets on a portfolio of companies. You know, out of 10 or 20 companies, you want to have one, you know, unicorn.
Yep.
That delivers most of the return. Then you might have a couple that are pretty good. And then you have ones that are like, well, they're just going to middle. And eventually we're going to stop funding them because we're not going to keep putting money in. This is something that seems like it's always going to be for whatever reason here. And then you've got the ones that failed. And hopefully they fail fast. And, you know, you have to set up a company to do that. And that is where you get a lot of this too, just as a little side comment. You get employees or leaders that want to, you know, make sure they get their paycheck and they're depending on that. And sometimes that impacts how they might make progress or discuss progress. The best thing that they can do for everybody is to, you know, push the technology and get it to fail fast, because inevitably you want it to work in a human. And you have to imagine at some point in time, saying, hey, we've done all this great work, but now we need to hand this to Dr. Miguel Montero Baker. He's a human being that's going to be using it on another human being in a chaotic environment. And there's a lot of usability and human factor stuff that go into it as well. So that's why we rely upon, and I know you would say this, Miguel, you would say, this sucks. This is not going to work. This is, you know, don't do this. I mean, that's, you know, companies need that as well. They need that honesty across the board, so we don't waste people. You know, we don't waste time.
What's the average time frame from the moment you engage, or like most people engage in one of these projects, to whatever type of endpoint scenario, being an exit, being, you know, a successful introduction to the market, failure? Is there a time frame?
The average half life of one of these companies in?
Yeah. Again, it sort of depends on what it is and the regulatory path. Mm-hmm. If you need to commercialize it to show, you know, that the customers like it and there's traction, like I said, the dog's eating the dog food. But, you know, it's 5 to 7 years.
Yeah.
It just takes forever. I mean, think about what's happened to you in the last 7 years.
Yeah.
That's the life of a startup. And, you know, Miguel, you weren't a father then. You know, there's so many things you can say, you know, like life moments that you think about that can happen within a 5 or 7 year period. You know, you can go gray or go bald like I did, you know, and in the last startup and this startup, I was way better looking last startup.
I think you're phenomenally well good looking still. Okay. Let me make that sure that for all our
viewers,
you should definitely go to the YouTube and look at this fine piece of man. Sean, let's talk a little bit more. Let's gravitate towards this company because I'm obviously very, very interested. I think it's the beginning of many other things. To think, you know, the for every vascular surgeon out there, the holy grail is to have a good vein to work with, mm-hmm. right? It's the holy grail for access, is the holy grail for a bypass. It's the holy grail for a CABG, right? I mean, it's like having conduit is the holy grail.
Rate limiting step.
Yeah. And, you know, it's what makes it or breaks it in many ways. And you and your team have decided to find a solution for the significant amount of people out there that just have tiny veins, which happens a lot, right? I mean, a lot of times you just look at it and it's like this little small vein, right? So can you give me a little bit more background? I know you gave us a high yield introduction, but let's kind of dive in. Like, who's idea, where does this come from? Where are we at? What have we learned? Let's dissect your current company.
You bet. So I mentioned I worked at a company called AngioDynamics a long time ago. In that particular role that I was in my start off in sales, I came across an interventional radiologist who was, you know, finishing up his fellowship at Hopkins. Moved back to his roots in Kansas City. His name is Dr. Nick Fernano. Nick Fernano is really, you know, he's obviously a fellowship trained interventional radiologist, but he's more of an innovator, and that's the life path that he chose. So I came across him, and then we departed, and then lo and behold, you know, gosh, 20 years later, I come to help him, you know, run this company where he's using this pump to dilate veins and solve these unmet needs that you discussed for vascular access, for CABG, for PAD, even using the technology as a temporary form of bypass, for arterial perfusion. If you can imagine how beneficial that might be.
Yeah.
And working
how
on some
did
of that
reconnection come about? How did you guys rekindle?
He recruited me
because it's not even rekindled. It's you guys remarried, right? I mean, allowing somebody to essentially run your company is almost as important as deciding who you're going to marry. That's a huge commitment. So what did you do?
Definitely. I mean, you take that vow, you know, when you choose mm-hmm. to be that the leader, you take a vow to say, I am committed to this. I'm going to work, you know, to my bones, just trying to make this happen. I'm going to will my way. I know I have to run through some walls, but it's also to, you know, there are many stakeholders, guys. There's the investors, you know, what kind of progress have you made? Thank you for your precious capital. We got to put it to work and, you know, be as efficient as we can. And we owe it to you to keep you updated. There's the clinicians that are involved. Hey, how's this coming along? And we're patient centric. It's really important to get to know the patient's journey and you know what they're going through and if we're just talking about dialysis again, going back to, hey, do I want to be a nephrologist? No, I don't, because I have to go and care for these patients that are sitting in these chairs. You know, God bless them. You know, we're trying to find a solution for them, and that drives it as well. But you're right. You know, when you become engaged, you take that, you know, that vow, that oath. To do everything you possibly can, and honestly, if we do it the right way, then you know we'll be rewarded. Not only intellectually, we'll feel like we helped quite a bit move the needle, opening up a new area of science. But it'll be meaningful from a financial perspective too.
Go through like an interview process with the board when you took this position, or was your relation intimate enough with the physician?
Nick.
With Nick, yep. That it was just a phone call.
Well, there was a process to it. Yeah, I mean, I didn't come to the company to be the CEO because I had worn that role for a while, and I said, well, I want to get more back in front of the customer, working with the physicians. If you're the CEO, you're you're so underwater with the business stuff and all the different moving parts that you, it is draining, and you don't get, you know, for me, the energy is I get to go back out in the field and talk to these doctors and help bring these.
So you're not CEO right now of the company?
No, I am. I am. Oh. So that I originally came in to not be. And so then
like, I don't want
to
be a CEO, but okay.
Well, that's all. That's also part of it. Like, okay, how am I going to manage not calling the shots? But I didn't want to be. There's many people like me that are like, hey, I'm going to go and be second fiddle over here for a little while, and I get to do something a little bit different and use my brain in different ways. Long story short, that didn't happen. I was asked to be the CEO. I did discuss that with the board. We have been working on it since. So I was not the CEO for about a month.
Okay. When did you start? When did this journey start?
So the journey with this, in fairness, would really, I would say, the spring of 2023. So we've been at it for a little over a year, just getting the data that existed, cleaned up, my goal just by learning is to work a lot with FDA, you know, get in front of them, build that relationship, build that trust, be very transparent, revealing, because at some level they're helping to facilitate innovation as well. You know, there's a lot of requirements, as any government regulated, you know, body, you have to jump through hoops. These regulations sometimes get out of control, but you do yourself a favor by building a relationship with FDA and showing them where you're at and being honest with, hey, I'm concerned about this animal model. For instance, we have to build an animal model to test this, the thesis of this technology in the way we want to, but it's really been designed for a human, but we're going to superimpose this technology on your little bitty animal and hope that, you know, it translates. So there's those, that's just an example of a particular challenge.
Interesting.
Yeah. Where are we at now with the company?
So we are, I'd say we're clinical phase because we have 10 patients that we've already enrolled. I mentioned at the front end. We had 2 5 patient cohorts.
This was US or OUS?
This is an OUS study conducted in Paraguay with Dr. Adrian Ebner. Have you heard of this guy?
Yep. Yes.
He does a lot of first in human work. And,
yeah.
But we had US physicians that went to the sites to do the procedures. And Miguel, you and I have done that before.
Yeah.
The patients there are in need. So, you know, for us, again, if you look at the data, across the board on average, significantly less than 2 millimeter diameter vessels. And as a vascular surgeon, you would say that's not going to work for an AV fistula. You know, yep. You probably 2.5 millimeters is where your cutting off point is for the most part, as I've understood. Starts with a venous mapping procedure, looking for a good access site. Our focus is on the forearm because that's where it should be, right? If we can get forearm veins to take, but unfortunately, just like a tree, the limbs and the branches get smaller and smaller as do the blood vessels. And they're problematic as targets for AV fistula creation. Our goal is to use this technology to dilate veins and then get them in a conditioning cycle, start the arterialization process so that we can have a high flowing vein. Let me back up. Increase the candidacy or a forearm access site creation.
Yeah.
And, you know, get that vein, that conduit large, and then have it be cannulatable, so functionally mature within 2 weeks. And in our data, our first in human data, FIM, we showed that we, around 36 hours, had already surpassed the 5 millimeter threshold. So that we have a nice histogram that shows how quick they dilate. And then there's the part of the blood flow going in as sort of conditioning and thickening the wall and getting it cannulatable. Yep. But that'll translate, and now I can hand you a patient that has a 5 or 6 or 7 millimeter vein to make it easier for you to make that anastomotic connection. You got then the arterial flow going in and doing what it would normally do, of course, over 16 to 18 weeks if it ever matures. And you preserve this site for future access for the patient to their benefit.
No, there's like nothing nicer as a vascular surgeon.
Yeah. Then I have to lump ass vein.
Well, but not even that, even better is than the arterialized vein. Like when you have to go and do an AV fistula revision.
Yeah.
Like it's so easy to handle that because it's almost like indestructible, right? Like you grab it and you can just manhandle that shit, right? You can like pull and scrub and remove and dissect and cut. And then you have this nice thick conduit and you just suture boom, boom, boom. Like it's just such a nice thing. So think if it was not only a vein that was a plump vein, but a little thicker than normal vein. So it's almost like an artery kind of looking vein because it's arterialized.
I
mean,
I think like the 36 hour time frame is amazing because that you can do that. I see a problem sending somebody with a centrifugal pump going into peripheral vein because I could see that shit dislodging and just like being a
somebody just bleeding out at Bucky's.
Yeah, exactly. But knowing our patients, that would happen.
Yeah. Oh no. They bled in the restroom at Bucky's.
Yeah. But like if it's 36 hours, that's a hospital stay.
So where do you take the blood? Where's the inflow from?
It's a central venous canal.
So okay, you put a central line. And then you connect a tube. I've seen this on paper, but that's why I'm walking our listeners. So you do a central venous access, then you connect it to this little motor. How big is the motor?
It's about it's about this big and about this thick.
So like a
I was about to say
like a disc player.
Oh my god!
No,
like a skateboard wheel.
Okay, so like a softball ball, maybe not a baseball.
Yeah. Smaller,
you think
like a golf ball that you flattened?
Seems like you haven't played softball.
That's
in a
pretty
while.
Small. Yeah. So it's like let's say baseball size at most. So this little motor now then has another tube that goes into the IV that you would put, I would think, as far distal as possible into the cephalic vein. Of the wrist. And so now that cephalic vein is going to have high pressurized flow.
Yep.
And that's what's going to lead to the maturity. In 36 hours, you keep them in house. You keep them in house or you send them home with this thing?
It goes back to being practical and pragmatic and regulatory considerations. But ideally, we would send them home. So they would come into a surgery center or HOPE. Mm-hmm. They would have their Amplify system implanted, send them home, and they come back in a couple days or once they assigned for surgery, and then you bring them in, and then you do the surgery. But for the first part, we're doing it in the hospital because we want to make sure we have the support staff and walk before we run, and that'll help us to show our case in terms of safety. To send them home. But
I mean, Sean, this sounds like a slam dunk. Like I'm trying to think any negatives.
How can we invest?
Well, we'll have that conversation offline. But but really, like what I don't do you see, can you foresee a major hurdle? It seems like it's just regulatory. It's
love bats and Bucky's.
Fine tuning side of service. Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, because here's what I think would kill your device. Okay, let me try to iron steel man the other position. If you really do it only inpatient, it still would be okay, but I think that would limit really expansion. So, you know, I think you want to get this into the hands of the people in the community. You really want to get this into the access centers, right? You want to get it into these interventional nephrology hands. Those are the guys that are going to be like very, very interested in doing this. Vascular surgeons, I think, are going to be interested, but I would say there's...
For a vein, man, by the time you get the cardiac workup to do a bypass, you hook this thing up before you start that. By the time the cardiac workup is back, you have a vein.
Well, you're thinking two steps down, which is some conversation I've had with Sean about, hey, we could do this in the GSV. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different ballpark. Mm-hmm. I think that what makes sense now is get the indication.
You could do it in the arm.
For cephalic.
For, like, you don't have a GSV, you could do it in an arm.
I know, but what... Focus. Yeah. They're trying to get this for access. For
Shiny access.
I'm trying to figure out what would potentially are his hurdles or his options trying to get this through the FDA. Okay, how do you approve it? Where do you approve it? What site of service do you approve it? What cost point do you put it at?
I mean, the majority of patients that come in with dialysis need are not the CKD stage 4 that are going to get an elective fistula, and then you're going to put it on. The majority of patients are going to come to compensate to the hospital. They're going to have medical issues that need to be solved. It's more than 36 hours. So you get a consult. You look, do a vein mapping while they do all the other stuff.
So you see this being an inpatient thing?
100%.
Mm. Sean, would you like this to be isolated to an inpatient code, or do you think there's a market in the outpatient setting of patients that, that could come in?
Yeah, I would answer that with both. And I think we're trying really, really hard. We say the world is trying to identify these patients earlier so they're not crash dialysis patients. But the majority of them are, right? And Luke, you laid it out where you already have them in there and you're triaging and you're doing these various things. So in the context of that, you could, map. And this is why I think it's a very vascular surgery focused opportunity, a new opportunity for the vascular surgeon, because it starts with mapping and identifying access sites, implantation of Amplify, explant of Amplify, concurrent with AV fistula creation, and then monitoring how that's going. And then, if you're in the right setting, then you're going to be taking care of that fistula you created for the life of that access site on behalf of that patient or on behalf of the nephrologist that you're working with. So I feel like this is a very vascular surgery focused opportunity. And yes, there are other specialties involved. If we do the job right, then we can help, patients in many, many ways. We can make them better candidates for home hemodialysis, which is something that's always been capped. You basically have to be independently wealthy and have an entire room dedicated to doing your home hemodialysis. You're turning one of your rooms in your house to a dialysis unit. You need to have, blood. You need to have, where do you filter the water? How do you bring the new water in, the fluids? It's a very difficult thing, but a lot of times they're afraid to do it because they're afraid to go through and through and ruin that access site. If you give them a bigger access site, you can make them better cannulators. You're helping the patient and the macro environment in many, many ways if we do this right.
I'm going to tell you the one hang up that you're going to have for the inpatient. They come in, they need dialysis, they're going to need a tunneled line. Is you're going to have some friction in getting two lines. So then you have to come up with a catheter that has the two ports for dialysis and your port for your pump.
If they're getting dialysis, that's another. So you're an innovator because you're thinking way ahead already. Yeah. So we can convert our. There's a path for us to convert. Sure.
Yeah. Our technology. You could just use a Y. Dialysis. Yeah. You would put a Y.
And just build your own catheter and sell it. Boom.
we you'd put a Y and they go to dialysis. They get dialysis. They're off the Amplify for the 3 hours, 4 hours.
You probably don't want to do that. You're going to introduce like clotting issues. Like you probably want to keep it on undisturbed.
What's the pressure? Variables. What's the output pressure of the cat? What pressure does it push into the vein?
So this is a great question. Glad you asked it because the technology isn't just a pump you put on and it's one size fits all.
Yeah,
it's engineered to ramp up algorithmically. So you're not dumping in 1,000 milliliters per minute into a blood vessel. You're graduating it up over time. So in 6 hours it goes to this, then 12 hours it goes to this. So it's all run by a little impeller. That's pulling blood out of the SVC right atrium into the pump and then back out another conduit down to this blood vessel, but it graduates over time. So it's all about wall shear stress as a function of time. And when a vein is a particular size, you have a pressure gradient that's A. And as the vein dilates, that pressure gradient changes. So therefore, you need to increase the flow as a result of that. And we have the type of technology that'll sense that, and the impeller will spin and it'll get faster and faster, meaning more blood will be moved as the vein enlarges over time.
This gives me an idea for something else.
So how about an average? Can you give me an average of how much pressure? When we do a fistula, you're arterializing a vein. A vein's normal blood pressure is 0 to 6 millimeters of mercury. Arterial flow is 120 millimeters of mercury, 120 under, 120 to 60 or 120 to 80, whatever. Do we have a measurement in the millimeters of mercury that we can, in our mind, picture as surgeons or no?
Yeah, so akin to the brachial artery, except for a differentiator is that it's not pulsatile.
So it's just going to be an ongoing. But can you give me a number or no? Is there no number that can be quotable?
We actually look at more on milliliters a minute in terms of flow.
Oh, okay.
Mercury. I'll have to bring the engineers in for that one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that'd be something interesting I'd like to see at some point. Just because I want to understand the histopathological or histological changes related to pressure A versus pressure B versus pressure C. Like, you know, 36 hours just sounds amazing. Like, it's almost like it's hard for me to believe that works that well and that fast. I would have thought that you'd take this puppy home for 2 weeks or a month and then you come back. And now it's like, looks nice. But the fact that this happens in such a succinct time is, I think,
that's huge.
It's huge, and it speaks very loudly about the potential.
Yeah, and just for the record, it'll take more than a couple days. The initial increase in diameter and flow rates happen very quickly, but we want to give the vein a kickstart into the arterialization process. So while the dilation occurs, 24, 36 hours, we keep it on for a few days just to help that arterialize. Then we pull. Now, we may find in our clinical study that we can even move it more on this side where we have that, first 24 or 48 hours. And then we can immediately convert to an AV fistula that starts to be, cannulatable at a couple weeks. Because really, that's what you're doing today, right? You're taking an artery connected to a vein, and then you're like, okay, let's watch the pain dry for, 6 or 8 weeks. We'll bring them back in. We'll see how it's doing, based on your own particular protocol. But usually, you say, this is going to take 3 or 4 months, to get ready to be used, if it's ever ready to be used, without having to do serious revisions or to go back in and really try to make it a functional site. We're significantly reducing that process and making the reality of it a lot higher. If we can do those two things, we'll have a winner.
Yeah, I think those two separate questions is like, okay, when do you turn the vein into a vein that is ready for surgery? And when do you turn the vein into a vein that's ready to cannulate? Obviously, cannulate's the end goal. So if you can do that in a short amount of period of time in a safe way, then yeah, that'll be your goal.
So our study will be a randomized study where we're looking at patients that have amplify or not have amplify. So we will have that head-to-head combat where we'll show, and we could use historical data, but that's worthless. So we want to, bring these patients in under the same inclusion-exclusion criteria and do the same, monitor the patients the same way, give them the same chance for success. But we'll start with, patients that are, 2 millimeters less, maybe a little bit more in that area. And predictably, we anticipate through the randomization process that we'll come out a winner. And we can look at our data we already have in first in human. Miguel, you mentioned histopathology of the tissue. So this is interesting because we can actually, it's very rare that you can take a human tissue that's been treated and then look at it.
Yep.
Under, because you could snip a little bit of the vein that's been treated prior to
absolutely.
Making the experience.
Absolutely. This is a very unique opportunity where you get this device to work. You set yourself up for surgical success. And oh, guess what? When you do an enticite anastomosis, you're actually snipping the vein. And oh, guess what? It's not rare that we actually purposely bevel and cut a little piece of vein. So everybody would then be... so essentially you're obligated by the protocol to take a little piece of vein and send it in. We'd get so much information. Like, I'm very excited for this project. I'm very excited for you, for what you've done with this. I think you've chosen this very smartly. It's a big bet because it's new, right? I mean, it's a regulatory pathway that's going to be painful, but I think that it shouldn't be that impossible. And I wish you all the best, you and your team, in this new venture, man. I'm excited to see where you can take it.
Appreciate it. And, I'll be knocking on your doors to help me make this a reality. Cause that's what it goes back to, is working with physicians on making sure that what you're working on is, has been well thought through, and how that's going to inevitably be a tool that you can use to help these patients. That's all important.
And we'll, you know how we'll know that there was success is when we invite him after the exit.
The big exit. And he's, instead of like...
I was about to say, it's not going to be that. It's going to be the Fiji Islands.
Yeah, it's like,
and he's going to be like, oh, I like updated my background. Now this is, let me show you the yacht.
Yeah.
So
from the boat.
But wait, I would like us to be in the yacht with you and we could record on site if that's fine.
Exactly. Let's make that happen.
Is that a promise?
It's a promise. I'm going to get a big enough boat where I can put your entire couch and your background in there.
It's just, it's simple. It's a couch. It's a couch, a camera, and a laptop, man. Yeah,
it's pretty simple.
Just, you know, it's, you know, maybe a 20-foot yacht would be fine.
And a margarita. 20 foot. Jesus Christ.
Something small.
No.
Listen, Sean, I know it's the weekend. I know you're on vacation and I know you're having time with your family. So I want to say thank you. We really do appreciate you doing this. It's been super enlightening and fun. And I think a lot of good take-home messages. And then exciting to know that there's new and unique opportunities for our patients and here in the near future.
Absolutely. So thank you again. I really appreciate it. It's always good catching up with you. We'll have to do it in person next time over a beer.
That's a promise. Lucas, any closing?
No, thank you so much, Sean. This was super interesting, super enlightening. So
sweet.
Appreciate that.
We'll give you back your time. Have a great time and we'll be in touch. Bye-bye. Bye. Pura vida.
Two vascular surgeons walk into a bar and come out with a podcast. We are talking everything vascular and not. Welcome to the life of Flow Podcast.